One of my own great consolations is to know that members of my family have suffered for the faith. That's the first martyrdom. Martyrdom of persecution. Not all the faithful who suffer for Christ also die for Christ. Often they wish they could. Opposition to the Christian faith and way of life does not always end in violent death for the persecuted victims. Consequently, it is well to distinguish between what may be called martyrdom of blood and martyrdom of opposition, which is bloodless indeed, but no less and sometimes more painful to endure. Immediately there comes to mind the persecution of the church in communist-occupied territories behind the iron or bamboo curtain. The persecution often ends in death. If not before the firing squad, then after years of imprisonment in Siberia or some labor camp. Not all the victims of persecution die at the hands of a godless government. Millions more are ostensibly free to walk the streets and live in a home. Yet they are, in effect, deprived of every human liberty to practice their religion and to serve Christ according to their faith. If they teach their children the catechism, the parents are prevented from enjoying such privileges as decent living quarters or any kind of skilled job. If they are seen attending church, they are first warned, then threatened, and finally penalized, even to the loss of all their possessions. How well I know from my own blood relations. So the sorry tale goes on, and has been going on for years in spite of the conspiracy of silence in our American press. But that is not the whole picture. We need to shake ourselves into awareness that our country, too, is undergoing persecution. It is no less real for being more subtle and no less painful for being perpetrated in the name of democracy. What do I mean? I mean that any priest or religious, any married or single person in America who wishes to sincerely and fully live up to his religious commitment finds countless obstacles in his way and experiences innumerable difficulties that accumulatively can demand heroic fortitude to overcome and withstand. All we have to do is place the 8 Beatitudes in one column and the 8 corresponding attitudes of our culture in another column and compare the two. where Christ advocates poverty, the world despises the poor and it canonizes the rich. Where Christ praises gentleness, the world belittles meekness and extols those who succeed in crushing anyone that stands in their way. Where Christ encourages mourning and sorrow for sin, the world revels in pleasure and the noise of empty laughter. Where Christ promises joy only to those who seek justice and holiness, the world offers satisfaction in the enjoyment of sin. Where Christ bids us forgive and show mercy to those who have offended us, the world seeks vengeance, and its law courts are filled with demands for retribution. By the world's standards, you never forgive. Where Christ blesses those who are pure of heart, the world scoffs at chastity and has made a god of sex. Where Christ tells the peaceful that they shall be rewarded, the world teaches just the opposite. In constant rebellion and violence and massive preparation for war, and where Christ teaches the incredible doctrine of accepting persecution with patience and resignation to God's will, the world dreads nothing more than criticism and rejection, and human respect, which means acceptance by society, is the world's moral norm. As anyone trying to live out the Beatitudes knows, the world not only does not believe in these Beatitudes, but with legal and financial and psychological power at its disposal, opposes those who do not accept the secularism of our day. Why the opposition? It is finally hidden in the mystery of evil. But we get some inkling of what lies behind the studied persecution by the worldly of the virtuous. That, by the way, has the pattern of all revealed history. The evil always persecute the virtuous. We get some inkling of what this means from a little known passage in the Book of Wisdom. The passage was written in the first century before Christ. It might as well have been written yesterday. There are two parts to this biblical analysis of why worldly people persecute those who are trying to serve God. In part one, the godless, as they are called, say to themselves with misguided reasoning that all they have to look for is what this world offers them. Come then, they argue with themselves, let us enjoy what good things there are, use this creation with the zest of youth. Let none of us forego his part in the orgy. Let us leave the signs of our revelry everywhere. Unquote, the sacred author. Next, they turned their attention to the faithful believers for a standing rebuke to the godless. Here is what they say. It's a little long, but bear saying. As for the virtuous man who is poor, let us oppress him. Let us not spare the widow, nor respect old age, white-haired with many years. Let our strength be the yardstick of virtue, since weakness argues its own futility. Let us be in wait for the virtuous man, since he annoys us and opposes our way of life, reproaches us for our breaches of the law, and accuses us of playing false to our upbringing. Before us he stands a reproof to our own way of thinking. The very sight of him weighs our spirit down. Let us test him with cruelty and torture, and thus explore this gentleness of his, and put his endurance to the proof. Unquote. Revelation. This is the way they reason, the sacred author explains, but they are misled. Their malice blinds them, so it does. But in the meantime, their malice also wreaks its hatred on all who try to serve God and refuse to compromise their religious convictions for the pottage of acceptance by the crowd. I have only one fear in saying what I am saying, is that you will not be able to identify fully with this type of person. Believe me, in today's world, you do not face the world with a full teaching of Christ without paying the martyrdom of opposition. As I experienced this afternoon in a long-distance telephone call, the martyrdom of witness, that's our third and last type of martyrdom. It is, in a way, the most pervasive of all, because no follower of Christ can escape this one. It is the martyrdom of witness. What do we mean by martyrdom of witness, and how does it differ from the other two? It differs from them in that even in the absence of active opposition, the imitation of Christ must always face passive opposition. From whom? From those who lack a clear vision of the Savior, or having had it, lost their former commitment to Christ. All that we have seen about the martyrdom by violence applies here too, but the method is different. Here the firm believer in the church's teaching authority the devoted servant of the papacy, the convinced pastor who insists on sound doctrine to his flock, the dedicated religious who want to remain faithful to their vows of authentic poverty, honest chastity, and sincere obedience, the firm parents who are concerned about the religious and moral training of their children and are willing to accept whatever offspring the Lord may send them, such persons will not be spared also active criticism and open opposition, but they must especially be ready to live in an atmosphere of cold indifference to their deepest beliefs. And as you know, we can die as much by fire as by the cold. Sometimes they would almost wish the opposition were more overt, and even persecution would be a welcome change. It is the studied indifference of people whom they know and love, of persons in their own natural or religious family, of men and women whose intelligence they respect and whose respect they cherish. This kind of apathy can be demoralizing, and unless it finds relief, can be, as I well know, devastating. To continue living a Christ-like life in this kind of environment is to practice the martyrdom of witness. Why witness? Because it means giving testimony to our deep religious convictions, although all around us others may be giving their own example to the contrary. It means giving witness twice over, once on our own behalf as the outward expression of what we internally believe, and once again on behalf of others whose conduct is not only different from ours but may contradict it. Wherein lies the martyrdom? It lies in the deprivation of good example to us on the part of our contemporaries, and in the practice of Christian virtue and loneliness, because those who witness what we do are, in the majority, numerically or psychologically, and we know they are being challenged and embarrassed by our testimony. We witness to them indeed, but they are not pleased to witness who we are, what we stand for, what we say, or what we do. Notwithstanding all of this, however, it behooves us to look at the positive side of the picture. We must remind ourselves that this witness of ours is not so sterile as may suppose. Quite the contrary. Although we may be, or at least feel, often quite alone, we are not alone at all. Not infrequently, our severest critics can become our strongest admirers. In any case, witness that we give by living up to the conviction of our faith is surely demanding on human nature. That's why we call it martyrdom. But it is a witness to the truth, And God's grace is always active in the hearts of everyone whose path we cross. If we would know the power of this martyrdom of witness, we have only to read the annals of the early church. And I don't hesitate saying, the apostolic age is once more alive in our day. The handful of believers whom Peter baptized on Pentecost Sunday were as a drop in the immense culture surrounding the Mediterranean Sea. Yet, see what happens. This small group of convinced faithful were able, in less than 300 years, to turn the tide of paganism in the Roman Empire. For a long time they were deprived even of the basic civil rights given to other citizens. They were often hunted like animals. And the catacombs tell us that they had to hide when celebrating the liturgy and hide the tomb of their revered dead. But their patience and meekness finally prevailed. Yes, but only because it was supported by unbounded courage, born not of their own strength, but of the power that Christ promised to give all his followers. That's And this is our hope, is the promise for us today. All that we need is to trust in the Spirit whom we possess and never grow weary in giving testimony to the grace we receive. This is what Christ was talking about when he told us not to hide our virtues, but to allow them to be publicly seen, like a candle on a candlestick, or a city on a mountaintop. We should not be afraid that by such evidence of our good works we shall become vain or proud. Of course, this is always a temptation, and we must strive to overcome. But in the normal course of providence, we shall be protected from vainglory by the cost in humiliation that witnessing to a holy life always brings. There will be enough death to self, and enough ignoring of human respect to keep us from getting proud in our well-doing. God will see to that. On our part, we must be willing to pay the price of suffering in doing good, which is just another name for being a living martyr, that is, a courageous witness to the life of Christ in the world today. Thank you for listening.